start with agenda paper 2. Testing of PP&E, or doing stuff with PP&E, I guess.
Good morning.
Kachiro?
Yes. Good morning. Agenda paper 2 addresses how to account for proceeds received before PPE is capable of operating in the manner intended by management. At a prior committee meeting, the committee asked us to work on various areas. After thorough analysis, we thought that if we were to attempt to resolve all of the questions raised in previous discussions, the solution developed would become very complex. Consequently, this paper explores approaches that would answer the questions submitted, but do not attempt to answer all questions raised during the previous discussions. Staff recommendation is a combination of clarification 1 and 2. Clarification 1 is to restrict the amount of income that an entity deducts from the cost of PPE to only those proceeds arising from testing. It also clarifies that the amount deducted should not exceed the cost of testing included as part of the cost of PPE. Clarification 2 is to clarify the meaning of testing. If the Interpretations Committee does not agree with the staff recommendation, then we recommend the alternative approach to prohibit the deduction of income from the cost of PPE, which is the approach applied in US GAAP. As in clarification 3, we also considered whether we could clarify when PPE is capable of operating in the manner intended. If the committee wished to address this issue, we would suggest an approach that would include in IAS 16 some indicator of when this is the case. The paper also addresses disclosure, however. We would suggest discussing the recognition of income and costs in the first instance and only then move on to disclosure. So our questions for the committee are, question 1, does the committee agree with the staff recommendation, that is clarification 1 and 2? Question 2, if not, does the committee agree with the alternative approach to prohibit the deduction of income from the cost of PPE? Question 3, alternatively, does the committee wish to clarify when PPE is capable of operating in the manner intended, which is clarification 3? Thank you.
Okay, in our internal discussions, it became clear that while this is a useful layout of the ordering of the questions, some people thought, well, clarification 2 actually belongs before clarification 1 and things like that. So let's start at least talking about clarification 1, and then if that breaks down, we'll go more of a free-for-all. Comments on clarification 1? Reinhardt?
I guess consistent with the comments that I've made at other meetings, I have difficulties with limiting the proceeds to be deducted against the cost of asset to those related to testing. I certainly understand and appreciate where the paper is coming from. I just look at the latter half of the sentence in paragraph 17E, and it talks about proceeds from selling any items produced while bringing the asset to that location and condition. And so, as I say, I think coming from a Canadian background, looking at the extractive industry, I really don't see any difference between proceeds from testing whether the mine and mill is operating properly and proceeds that you might receive while sinking a mine shaft and selling ore as you're sinking that mine shaft during the development phase. And so, as I say, I have difficulty with limiting it only to proceeds from testing, and then similarly with respect to having a ceiling on the limit. I just think it's difficult. The paper does acknowledge the difficulties in determining costs, but I think in practice the difficulties are significant. And so perhaps, Wayne, just to while we're talking about clarification one, I think given all the issues around it, if I do agree with the staff that this is something that would make sense for the ISB to address, and as part of stepping back and looking at the IS 16 requirements, and appreciating all the difficulties with what proceeds to deduct, how much to deduct, etc., I do have sympathy for the alternative approach of just all proceeds to the P&L.
And as I recall, Canadian companies were using U.S. GAAP before. Any of them that were traded in the U.S. were using U.S. GAAP.
Old predecessor Canadian GAAP did permit deduction of some nominal proceeds against the cost of the asset. Our standard on fixed assets was based on IS 16, but it was not just limited to testing. But having said that, once the IFRS conversion occurred, there have been some clarifications by the SEC. Those mining companies that are reporting under U.S. GAAP are accustomed to doing the alternative.
Yep. Okay. I see a light flashing on the board, but I don't know. Is it Young Soo that you wanted to come in?
Yeah,
okay.
I just want to say I concur with the mining. I am not that much comfortable with doing this because we have to see it's only up to the cost of testing. I think I have two reasons for it. The first one is about the, I should say, law material, the kind of logical reasoning. I don't see the logical reasoning of the limiting the net cost is only up to the cost of testing. That's the first point I want to say. And the other one I want to say is, what are we going to do with the excess amount of net proceeds? If we limit the amount, then there's going to be some net proceeds that's going to be exceeding the cost of testing. And I don't know what to do with that. If we just recognize as a value, that means that we don't start a business yet, but recognize value, which is not the same. So my only concern is that limiting would be very confusing, but it might not be the right.
Martin?
Yeah, I also believe that it's challenging to split the proceeds and to limit the cost of testing. I mean, for sure, in general, if we talk about cost, it is clear that cost might not be negative. However, in terms of negative interest, one could also consider whether costs are a negative element. However, I also see the argument of Young Soo, and specifically the question is if these kinds of costs are limited, what is the remaining part? And I believe it's challenging that the remaining part belongs to IAS 1621, to call it net proceeds, because it is not defined under 1621. So that would mean that we would have to add a little bit in 1621, or at least make it clearer how to handle these surplus, so to say. And again, from an operational perspective, I'm with Reinhard. I believe that it might be sometimes challenging, really, to split the proceeds.
You say how to handle it. I assume it goes in the income statement. If you have proceeds in excess of costs,
yeah,
it goes to the income statement.
Yeah, but are you really able to measure your cost of testing? What is your cost of your employee cost, it's energy, and so on.
So your
specifically
your
for these
cost
inventories, you are selling. Yeah. So.
Okay. Andrew?
Yeah, like others who've spoken, well, first of all, I do agree that to answer the question as originally put to us, an amendment to IS 16 is the more appropriate course of action than trying to do this with an agenda decision. But that said, like others who've spoken, I'm not convinced this is the right amendment. I don't really understand why testing has some special status such that net proceeds from testing should be dealt with differently to net proceeds from any other activity that's necessary to bring the asset into the location and condition, etc. It just seems rather arbitrary and rather rule-based, and we should be looking to clarify the principle if necessary, which is either simply that you capitalize the gross cost or that you capitalize the net cost. This is neither of the above. This is extrapolating perhaps a rather ambiguously worded example into a rule, which I find difficult to support. So of the two proposals on the table, my preference would be to prohibit the deduction of any proceeds, but I think that should be accompanied by some additional guidance on the cost attribution question.
Philippe?
Andrew, could I ask you why you think that other activities that are necessary to bring the asset into its condition would have any proceeds associated with it? I mean, transportation, the programming, etc., whatever is necessary to bring the asset, there is no proceeds associated. It's only the testing, which may, in certain cases, have some proceeds. So is there really an issue here? Or?
Well, as the, I think the well-discussed issue of certain extractive industry practices, I question whether there's any real difference between the testing activity, there isn't any testing activity as such, and just sinking the mine shaft or whatever it might be. I think another example in certain development type activities, there can be some incidental materials, maybe in demolishing a building, something like that, incidental materials that you can then sell. Okay. So I think there is a wider issue here.
Okay. I think, Bob, you're up next.
I, just the contrary opinion, I agreed with the staff's view. I could also see the alternative approach. What I struggle getting my mind around is if we weren't to limit the proceeds now, thinking outside of the extractive industry, just thinking of a normal manufacturer piece of equipment, if I didn't limit the proceeds, then my understanding would be then I could potentially be limiting other costs associated with that piece of equipment, which I struggle with. Proceeds were greater than the cost of testing. Now I start into eating into the cost, the purchase price of the equipment, the transportation to get the equipment into its location.
I think you're agreeing with the suggestion to have the kind of cap,
see
the amount of the capitalized cost. Yeah.
Okay. Sandy, are you still on the line?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Why don't you, do you have something to add here before I go to others?
I don't know. I don't know that it's actually resolvable. You know, and I'm more in line with disclosing some of these things so that the market can see what the numbers are, but I know that's not what's being proposed. I just don't know that, you know, they're all good questions, but we could debate them for a good long time. But the reality is that people just want to make their own judgment about whether they think somebody's capitalizing or deducting a good deal of costs or proceeds from testing. So I don't know. I hear all the debates. I don't know how we resolve them, but you know, I just think that disclosing them would give market participants information they'd like.
Okay. Let's take just a second for.
Wait, it's Bai Long Li.
Ah.
Hi.
Please, Bai Long, go ahead.
I agree with the staff recommendation to classification 102 to amended standard, but I have a couple of issues related to the application of classification 102. The testing periods built over maybe more than one accounting period. Cost incurred, but products produced during the testing not yet sold. Cumulative or period by period assessment of cost versus income, etc. It's kind of one issue. Second issue is costing of items produced for scenarios where the net proceeds is higher than costs. Like what should be capitalized or is inventory costed, or when should this be captured?
Okay. Thank you for that. Now that I have back control over the magic board here. Bruce, you're up next.
Thanks, Wayne. I guess when I read it, I mean, I can see the arguments on both sides for this, but the thing that's still in the back of my mind keeps sticking to me is this concept of revenue, is the fact that we've got an amount that's coming in. To me, this is income, and yet what we're trying to do is we're trying to somewhere along the line draw an arbitrary point at which this is revenue or is not revenue and then suddenly becomes revenue. And I guess maybe the concern I had was similar to maybe some of the ones that others made, that we operationalizing this to me is going to be very, very difficult. I think it's going to create a great situation for companies to be able to adjust that where they want it to be. Because, I mean, these costs are there, but we all know what it's like to get mixed into this and that. And I just get a bit concerned. So from my point of view, I think the more practical and the easier way to apply this would be to take the US approach and just not allow the capitalization of these. That would be my preference.
Okay. Carl?
I agree with staff's recommendation, but I also struggle with the ceiling and the principle behind the ceiling. I would like to see further arguments to support the ceiling.
So you would say if the proceeds were net negative,
yes,
you'd be happy to offset them against. Okay. And your view on the alternative approach? Others, you don't like the alternative. Okay. Tony, you're next.
So, probably like I've said in previous meetings, I'm not sure there's significant diversity in practice at the moment. So, I'm not sure that that changing practice would necessarily be helpful. I tend to agree with Reinhardt that you could probably read IAS 16 today more broadly than it has been read in connection with the staff's recommendation. And so I think there is a relatively consistent practice today of deducting all proceeds up to the point that the asset is ready for use. And I think that's something that's applied without causing too much trouble. So I think if we were amending the standard, which I think is where the staff is going with all of their recommendations, I would probably see that as first prize, to have all proceeds deducted. I agree that we should answer the question we've been asked, so we shouldn't broaden it out to think about when an asset is ready for use. I do think what the proposal in clarifications 1 and 2 is pretty much a rule, like Andrew. I don't see the basis for arbitrarily deciding that we'll limit it to the cost of testing. But perhaps more important than that, I think it will be a significant practical challenge, because companies are going to have to decide what are the costs of testing, which is something they probably don't do today. And then they're going to have to apportion the income between the cost of testing and what goes into the income statement. And so I think if the committee feels that there isn't a basis to deduct all the proceeds from the cost of the asset, then I would prefer the alternative, which takes them all to the income statement, simply because that is simple. I understand the concern that why do I get revenue before I've decided my asset is ready for use. On the other hand, looked at in isolation, they would meet the definition of revenue. And so I can see a conceptual basis for doing that. So I think at the end, I would not support the recommendation to go with clarification 1. I would prefer an approach that says all proceeds get deducted, but if we were looking for another practical solution, it would be everything in the income statement.
Clarifying on revenue, if you went with the staff recommendation, would you cap it at the amount capitalized, or would you actually have a negative asset?
I wouldn't go with the staff's recommendation.
You wouldn't?
No.
So what would you do then?
I think all or nothing. Either you deduct everything or...
But in principle, you could have a negative asset then. If you actually got lucky on the test, you know, had a lot of output to sell.
I wonder if that's a particularly extreme example that not sure it's worth.
I don't know if it is or not. I'm just trying to make sure I understood what you were saying. I'm not suggesting we should do that.
I think if it went negative, I'd put it in the income statement. But I think it's probably...
It's at the sixth standard deviation.
Yeah.
I would challenge though, just to share the benefit, you know, when I was in practice, I think companies probably do know the cost of testing. If you're following any sort of project management tool, you know, you got design, you've got conceptual formulation, you actually have phase gates, whether it's a time to market model or some of the other ones, where you're probably aggregating costs. Now, it might be, you know, the amount of testing by virtue of cumulative cost, less cumulative cost at some earlier gate, but I suspect big companies probably, within some tolerable managerial accounting basis, know the cost of testing.
I suspect, my sense is that it would add a layer of complexity, because if you are, I'd use Reinhardt's example, sinking a mine shaft, you've got people working on the capital cost, sinking the shaft, building the asset. Then you have to try and separate out a component of what they're doing around testing. Now, obviously it could be done. I just think it's adding a layer of complexity.
Well, I didn't say it's adding today. Complexity. I just think managerial accounting-wise, you probably know it within, you know, some windage and elevation accuracy, because that's how you manage projects, is by milestones and phase gates.
I think you probably manage the cost of the project, whether you necessarily separate it. But I might defer to Reinhardt, who's probably more familiar with the industry than I am.
Reinhardt? And then we got to get John back in.
Yeah, just very quickly, I would agree with everything that Tony said. I think practice seems to be pretty generally, at least in the extractive industry, to deduct all proceeds against the cost of the asset. And in the whole scheme of things, relative to the cost of the asset, those proceeds aren't that significant. And the reason, I think that touches on, I think it's maybe clarification three, but what's really the biggest issue, which is when is the asset deemed to be capable of operating as intended by management? And if you've got, it seems to me that clarification one, limiting proceeds to the amount of cost of testing, is kind of a backdoor way at getting at clarification three, which is when is the asset ready for production? If you've got a rigorous thought process and rigorous criteria for when the asset is capable of operating as intended by management, and that period is relatively short, in practice we never see negative assets. And I think the issue, if I recall back to the discussions we've had over the past number of months, the issue is that in some countries perhaps, the period of time when the asset is considered to be under development seems on the surface to be too long. You know, 4 or 5 years, that doesn't seem right. And so, as I say, in practice, because you don't have a lot of proceeds relative to the costs you've incurred, at least in the extractive industry, and that time frame is relatively short in terms of when you're actually testing or doing other kinds of activities to make sure it's operating as intended, you never see negative assets.
I think in discussing this with the people who proposed, who asked us initially whether they should submit it, their concern was not that an asset had gone negative. Their concern was that it was kept in the testing phase so long that its carrying amount was so low that when it actually was considered to be finished, it would look unreasonably profitable or would never possibly be impaired because there wasn't hardly any left. Their concern was more income management than having a negative number. John?
I mean, I think at the heart of this issue is a question of cost attribution. I mean, I think that the reality of these complicated construction projects and development projects is that companies are actually producing and developing at the same time. So having this single threshold of capable of operating as intended by management is actually a very unsophisticated approach towards determining when you move from being in construction or development of the asset into production. What they're doing is developing and producing at the same time. And they're avoiding proper cost attribution between the asset, the inventory, and the PP&E by using something, paragraph 17E, which I don't believe was ever intended to allow proceeds during the development phase, no matter where they came from, to be credited to the cost of the asset. It was actually to deal with the situation where you're producing samples and you're generating some proceeds during a testing phase to say, well, you can deduct that off the cost of testing. So at the heart of this issue to me is the cost attribution between the inventory you produce during the development phase and the PP&E. I mean, I would support the staff clarification proposal because I think it actually properly clarifies what 17E is for. And I think 17E is being used in a way today that it was never designed for it, in my view, and therefore I think the clarification helps. What it doesn't do is answer what you do with those other proceeds from the other things that are not testing. And therefore, I mean, I could also support the alternative approach to say, well, if it's proceeds, it's in the income statement. It's got nothing to do with the cost of your PP&E.
Okay, let me see if I can. Tony, did you want to come back in, or did
I just forget?
I've heard a lot of different views. I'm struggling to see where a consensus is. Staff recommendation for clarification one is, as I read it, and correct me if I'm wrong, team, focus on the idea of testing as opposed to other proceeds. How many of you, as your first preference, this is one where you might get to vote more than once, how many of you, as your first preference, favor that approach? Four. Okay. How many, as your first preference, would read the sentence from 16 differently and say, such as means for example, which means that it should not in any way be limited to testing? So would favor an approach that worked on all proceeds?
All proceeds capitalized.
All
offset against the cost of the asset.
Yeah, all proceeds,
in a sense,
before the asset is ready for use, credited to the asset.
Six.
Okay. Let's go forward for the moment on that basis. I'm not going to ask for a view of the alternative approach, although several of you did say that you would accept that. Bob?
We didn't get on the phone any of the votes from them.
Ah, thank you.
Sorry, I
Sandy, what was your first preference?
I couldn't hear the first one.
Okay.
I got the second one, which is not limited to testing. All proceeds go against the assets, but I didn't get alternative number one. Sorry, I didn't.
Alternative number one was the staff recommendation to limit it to testing. So you're in the all proceeds group. Baylong? I'm sorry, Sandy. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I don't like either of them, honestly. I'd rather it all go to the income statement, but okay, at least you could see it. But
I intentionally didn't ask about the alternative yet. I'd like to go forward because we had enough people whose first preference was all proceeds offset. I'd like to pursue that a little bit and then ask about the alternative. So if in that case you'd be an all proceeds offset?
No, I'd actually prefer the staff recommendation then.
Okay, you'd prefer the staff recommendation. Feilong?
Yeah.
I also take the staff recommendation as my preference.
Thanks, Bob. Now we got a tie.
Surely you have a vote at this point, Wayne.
No, I don't. Under any circumstances. Okay. Well, we might as well. The house is working. How many is your first preference? How many would support the alternative view, regardless of what your first preference is? Oh. That's brilliant.
9, 10 in the room.
Ten in the room. Sandy, I think you've already said that your first preference was the alternative.
Yeah, if the only other option is to put them all against it, yep. Mm-hmm.
Baylong?
Yes, what's the question?
The question was, would you support, I mean not object to, the alternative view that's printed in the paper, which is everything to the income statement? You would support?
Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant, Katrina. I knew there's a reason to have you here.
I'm going to go downhill from here, by the way.
Okay. Given those decisions, I'm question whether talking about clarification 3 is necessary.
I think not, unless anybody
okay.
thinks it's necessary.
Now, if I think before we take this forward, we need to see precisely what kind of an amendment would be necessary to accomplish that. I suspect it's not just striking out a few words. I suspect something actually would have to be added to the standard. And I doubt my understanding, Bob, of U.S. GAAP is that it is more a case of that which is not permitted is prohibited. So there are a few explicit prohibitions in U.S. GAAP, if I recall. It's just people don't offset if they don't have.
It's not permitted. So
if it's not permitted, you don't do it. Yeah. That which is not permitted is prohibited. So we're not going to find anything in U.S. GAAP that's specifically on point to rely on. Martin?
Probably just one thought. I like this conclusion. Probably we should consider what happens to other cost of quality assurance after we have a product which is more or less ready. You might have a regulatory obligation to do quality assurances on your product, and you would also not capitalize these kind of costs. Yeah, you would directly deduct them from the proceeds.
So that wouldn't be part of your standard cost system. They would be a separate item.
Right. So therefore, that would be then in line with what is testing. Testing is nothing else as doing a kind of quality assurance. So just as an idea.
Okay.
Can I ask
yes.
Maybe I could just ask a clarifying question, and I'm sort of fearful of asking it at the same time, which is in talking a bit about the alternative approach in terms of doing an amendment on the face of it. I agree, Wayne, I think it's not just striking through a few words. We could add a few words as well to be clear that we're saying any proceeds, any income streams coming in before, you know, whilst the, yeah. the PP&E is being made ready for use, essentially, would be recognised in profit or loss. But I have heard a couple of conversations about, oh, well, do we need to then write something more about what happens to the costs? And so whilst my question was going to be, do you think all of you, you know, supporting the alternative approach, do you think we'd need to have to start to write lots of things into this amendment about what you do with costs? So that's my fearful question of the response. I suppose my starting point was to think that I wouldn't want to do a lot on the cost side, because you would already just feed off whatever is in IS 16 on cost capitalization, or IS 2 on, you know, putting together your cost of inventory to the extent that was there, and we wouldn't necessarily be starting to create a lot of extra words in IS 16 about anything to do with cost.
I agree with you, Katrina. I think IS 16 addresses what you do with the costs, or IS 2 would address what you do with the costs. I think what we'd be talking about is a clarification about what you do with credits.
Yeah.
So proceeds. So I would not dip into costs.
Yeah, I was just going to make the same comment. I think there's two existing standards that tell you what to do with costs. So.
Excellent. Great.
All right. Well, that's what we will pursue. We'll bring something back to you then that shows you what the amendment would look like. One of my questions was, what can we do? Can we do any of this as an interpretation? This is the one answer that cannot be an interpretation. We can't interpret the literature to say something disappears, much as we'd like to sometimes.
So it will be a narrow scope amendment in effect?
Yeah. It has to be.
And what we bring back, do we think it's appropriate today, to the extent anybody wants to talk about if there's any disclosure needed in addition to the alternative approach?
If you're in the situation of the alternative approach. We still have the question of what disclosure is either necessary or useful. Sandy, did you have a view on this? You're usually our disclosure person.
I don't think you didn't say that like it was a compliment.
No, I actually meant it as one. You're the one who keeps us honest.
Well, you know, if I listened to the whole conversation and as I read the paper, you know, it seems as though part of the struggle is we don't have any empirical information with respect to what costs we're capitalizing, any insight into sort of how long the process goes. And those are the things that, you know, investors are really interested in. As far as disclosures go, I mean, it would depend on what you actually decide, where you actually decide to put things, right? I mean, it shouldn't, but it will. So if you have certain costs that are capitalized, people will want to know what those were and what the nature of them is and why they were capitalized. And then if you decide to consider some that are testing, they would want to know what those are. And if there are things that we put everything to the income statement, well, they'll see those and they'll ask those questions. So it sort of depends on what you decide, but, you know, I just look at it and say it's really hard to make some of these decisions because we don't really have all of the empirical information about what people are doing. It's all sort of anecdotal. And so information that helps the user of the financial statement make that determination, because I think some of what people are going to want to see is whether particular entities are particularly aggressive, because it's sort of in a behavioral evaluation of management. But I don't know if that helps. But
okay, thank you. Bruce?
I was just going to say, especially when we're coming to the credits, I mean, aren't we in essence just saying that this is revenue and IFRS 15 will cover the disclosures? So, you know, to start putting more disclosures here, I just think is crazy.
Tony?
Going to say exactly the same thing, just issued a standard with 5 pages of disclosure requirements. I would not be inclined to add any.
Martin?
I would support further disclosures. On the other hand, I believe if it is that material, that it is margin dilutive, which could happen in a way, yeah, then I'm pretty convinced that management would do any disclosure anyhow. Yeah. So IRS 1, I believe, gives us sufficient guidance just in case if something is very material, then it will be disclosed.
Reinhardt, and then I'll ask Fei Long.
I don't disagree with what others have said. I do think, though, however, that revenue that's being put into the income statement before the asset is capable of producing as intended by management is not really consistent with the ongoing revenue stream that you would expect to see when the asset is up and running. And similarly, the costs, as we've talked about, because you're not depreciating the asset yet, the margins won't be consistent. So I think we probably need to look at IFRS 15, IS 1 as to whether the concepts would cover, disclosing that type of information, assuming it's significant. It probably does, but I think it's worth just reflecting on that the revenue, those costs, the margin is not really consistent with what one would expect to see once it's operating.
We'll take a look at that in the context of bringing you back the proposed amendment.
I think, just to interject, I think Reinhardt makes a good point. You know, as we look at the revenue disclosures, much of the disclosures are very articulating very much the qualitative estimates that are being made. The only real quantitative information, which is what I'm talking about here, is about sort of giving it by geography or some element of disaggregation in a different way, not by the type of item per se, but more about the geography. I think this is a little different than what those criteria, if I remember them off the top of my head, would suggest. So I just want to echo Reinhardt's comment.
Okay. I think I promised to bring Fei Long in at this point. Fei Long, anything on this point?
I agree with some of the members said that at this moment, I don't think we need to add any guidance on this, any requirement for the disclosure, because sufficient guidance existing. Unless we don't take any action for the classification. So as long as we take the classification 102 or other alternative to prohibit and it just like the US GAAP, I don't think and we need any further guidance for that, for the disclosure.
Okay. Yong-Soo and then Bonnie.
Robert Reinhardt, in that, you know, this is the something that should be disclosed, because, you know, this is not from the ordinary business. This is something from non-ordinary business, so that this information might be important for the other people. So after we search through the other standard, if there's no requirement for disclosure of this type of the expenditures, then we have to think about putting some disclosure requirement.
Okay. Bonnie?
Yeah, I just have the same comment. I agree with Reinhardt, particularly from a margin perspective. I would expect that there might be higher margins rather than dilutive margins, I guess, the way I was thinking about it, just because you're not amortizing or depreciating the asset, which I would think management would want to call out, particularly if it's higher than what the expectation is and if it's for a limited period of time. But I agree that we should look at IFRS 15 and see if the other required disclosures would already cover it or if we need something separate. So I agree.
Fortunately, we have somebody here who's marginally familiar with IFRS 15. Fun?
Yes, please. Thank you. We agree that additional disclosures are not required, but we were rather surprised about paragraph 41, the message in paragraph 41, because that says this is because those clarifications might result in the amount of net proceeds deducted from the cost of PPE being immaterial for the vast majority of the entities. And that was the reason to say, okay, we shouldn't require the disclosure. And then we were wondering, in view of what is stated in the practice statement, the exposure draft practice statement on materiality, where it says when a disclosure is not material, there's no need to provide it. So when I bring this idea to what is in the paper here, then I would expect if there are certain industries where these disclosures are relevant, a disclosure requirement will be in the interest of users, because only those will be required by IFRS to disclose, and for those for whom the disclosure is not relevant, they are not required to do so. So I would like to put this message forward.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what we'll do then. We will. May or September?
Chung-Woo? I guess before making a final conclusion on disclosure, maybe we need to investigate the experience of the U.S. markets and companies. As many people have suggested, there is some kind of risk because these are higher, exceptionally higher margin than regular normal operations. So maybe this is a kind of against the prudence we are considering the conceptual framework, I guess. So that's why I'm suggesting a little careful approach on this and the all income recognition. So maybe we need more investigation, the experience in the U.S.
We will try. I think what Sandy told us, though, was that there isn't any. That it's going to be very hard to find any evidence in the U.S. market of anybody making an explicit disclosure unless there's something that's just hideously out of line.
That makes sense.
Yeah, if everybody routinely doesn't deduct these costs and puts them in the income statement, then everybody, we don't have much disclosure of I think the concern that many people raised was these potentially distort margins. It's your last day, you're going to break up the furniture? This is what we have to look forward to from FRAG, isn't it? We'll look, Chung Wu, but I'm not optimistic that we'll find much of anything. Bonnie?
No, I think that's a fair point. I'm not as familiar with this piece of U.S. GAAP literature. I'm not from the industry, so I think it's worth probably checking. But as to my comments before, if it is something material that's going to impact margins, I would have expected that U.S. companies or companies following U.S. GAAP would explain that type of variance in their MD&A type disclosures when they're explaining kind of, you know, gross margin, saying X amount is related to testing or something like that, or proceeds from preparing something for use. So, and that's, I guess that was my point of, if there's something else that covers this under existing IFRS, then I wouldn't put something specific. But I think it's worth kind of thinking through if this is a new approach under IFRS to see if we have something already or not. If not, then perhaps it's an elaboration that needs to be made.
To show my GAAP, my U.S. GAAP geekdom or geekness, Bob, does the old development stage company standard help us with this at all? Okay.
Just to make an observation about, like, except the mathematical issue on margin, but I would think if you're an established company and that you're always got production wells and mines and production plants, you know, that are sort of in scope, testing is just something you do. There's always stuff in testing. There's always still the lion's share of what you do has to be ongoing activities. So at some point, it's just there's a sort of a constant effect on margin down at the bottom of your margin analysis. And so there's the effect on margin, but I suspect it's the incremental effect or changes on margin. But if you're doing this on a regular business, I wonder how much effect there would be. Now, in a startup company or a small company that really is getting, you know, hitting its stride, I think it's different. I think established companies, it's hard to believe, you know, that margin is going to swing wildly because of testing. I'm just giving a visceral reaction. I can't prove it, you know, but it just.
Okay.
If it's June 9, it'll probably be the only thing in the income statement.
So that'll be relatively obvious.
Yeah, if you're a startup, everybody believes that startup, you're not getting what the ongoing is going to be. So, yeah. All right, let's wrap this up.
Yeah. Just to quickly summarize then, I think what we'll bring back is we'll have a look at the disclosure requirements that are already in IFRS that may apply to the scenario. We'll let you have a look at what the amendments to IAS 16 would look like. And the other piece we just mentioned in the paper that we'll ask you a question on is just about transition requirements that would go with the amendments. So we'll bring that back next.
Basically, this is adopting the alternative method.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know, in transition, you think if it's netting revenues, I mean, it can't. One has to think it's, you know, assuming you do it prospectively, it doesn't strike me as something that's the hardest thing to do. But I'd be curious as to what research you come back with.
No, I don't think it's difficult. It's just we haven't brought that to the committee, so we'll bring that next time.
All right.